everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at reversethieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month.
All right, so going on the blog, of course, Otakon. It happened. We've been talking about it. We're going to talk about it on this podcast. We'll never stop talking about it. So, of course, there's blog posts about it as well.
And if you want to hear us still, but with some other people, we were just on the Annie Gamers podcast. We recorded it just after it finished up while we were all resting in our hotel rooms. You've got Pats from The Cockpit, Carl from Ogiway Maniacs, and of course Evan from Annie Gamers talking with us about kind of our, you know, just our just out of the moment feelings about Otakon. This is kind of our more nuanced thoughts.
Yeah, whatever.
Look, Kate, I'm trying to sell a narrative.
It was a good job until I just sarcasmed right in there. And I did my manga of the month this month is Ace of the Diamond. I've been kind of slowly going through a lot of the sports manga that are now available. A lot of them have showed up in my manga of the month. But while writing about Ace of the Diamond, I was just struck by how heartfelt my review of that is. So I got like I felt pretty emotional about it. I think it's a really, really strong series. So if you don't feel like diving into a really, really long anime, the manga is really, really long, but it's not really, really long yet in English. There's only 4 volumes out.
So you can get on that train early.
Exactly.
I'm trying my hardest while we record this to catch up with Fate Apocrypha. They always release some kind of Type Moon anime now when Otakon comes on. So when I do my episode reviews, it's always like this. Like, I always slow down when we're getting close to Otakon, and then it just always throws me behind schedule when Otakon. So it's always this long, sloggy return as I'm like, I'm recovering from Otakon, and I have to like catch up with these posts and write my Otakon posts. But I'm almost there. Like, the end is in sight. I'm like, if I
can, you can do it. You can make it.
If I can finish, I'm like 60% through this week's. So if you kind of like want to vaguely keep your eye on it while you wait for it to officially come out on Netflix, you can read my reviews. Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing.
So, the ongoing investigation section is going to be a little shorter this month because we want to talk a lot about Otakon in the second half, so the second half's a bit longer than usual. And our food for thought will be Otakon related.
And apologies to anybody who likes the news section, so it's like, I just feel like that has just gone so neglected.
What do you mean? What?
Like, we didn't do news last month because...
Yeah, we did.
Oh, we did?
You're thinking Anime Next, the month before?
Right, yes, you're right.
That's how fast time passes, Al.
I didn't realize that, huh? I'm like 40. It's all beginning to compress at this point, Kate. Time dilation.
So, we did have news last month. We'll have news next month. Right? Yeah, I was like, wait, is Comic-Con next month? No, we have a respite.
So okay, stop the time dilations.
Well, I'm wishing our lives away here, but con by con. Kind of picking up, though, on last month's episode, we are going to continue to talk about Space Runaway Ideon. We are, you know, making our way through. We watched just 3 episodes this month. Again, Otakon, thank you. But, you know, I think we're starting to get more of a sense of the Buff Clan. And as far as I know, my major note about them was that they're sarcastic. I was like, sarcasm, this is all I wrote. Because they're in this, you know, they're the type of military or royalty or nobles or whatever you want to call them that, of course, are all, like, competing with each other all the time, so they're kind of backstabbing each other even though they're on the same side, which is complicating everything because Karala is still with the humans, and so now everyone's in competition to either rescue her or pretend rescue her and accidentally kill her in the process.
Yeah. Just picking back on what you're saying, because I think it's interesting, but the humans are kind of a little more unified, but, like, you know, there's always Bess's, like...
Yes!
Bess's, like, Cheryl, why did you get out of the kitchen and try to do science stuff all over here? Go back there!
But didn't he have a moment where he... You know, he was saying, let's not attack or something. He had a moment where he was all not military for 5 minutes.
Well, you know, it's interesting... I was thinking about this today because I knew we were going to be talking about it. And I feel like one of the major points so far that I can tell about Ideon is people not communicating, which I think, like, is so funny considering, like, I just listened to an Anime World Order and, like, they feel like Tomino has a real problem communicating with people, especially like expressing certain amounts of ideals. Like, you get the feeling that...
Wait, himself?
Yeah.
Through, like, his series or just him talking to people?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
But, like, how a lot of times, like, the perfect example is, like, Jireko, how there's a bunch of stuff that, like... makes the series make a lot more sense if you read supplementary materials, or, like, a lot of times characters' motivations seem odd, but you get an impression that Tomino realizes why these characters do it in his head, but he doesn't express it well.
Yeah, it doesn't feel haphazard. You feel like he knows the answer, but I get what you're saying, is that it feels very deliberate. It never feels as though he's just winging it. He has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah, but I feel like one of the major themes of this series is people not communicating. Like, there's a bunch of times, like the flag episode especially, where if people would just communicate more, there's a lot of times where people go, all right, this happened, so I'm going to assume this, and this is my response. But if they had just asked another person or asked the other side, they'd, like, have cut out a bunch of misunderstanding. And, like, knowing how the series ends, because it's kind of infamous for its ending, you know how it's going to play out, but... at this point you wonder, like, will these sides ever come to kind of any understanding? Even between, like, members of the Buff Clan or members of, you know, the solo colonists, there's a lot of, oh, if you would only talk to me beforehand, all of this could have been avoided. Like, when Maya dies, how much of that could have been avoided if she had just told her plan to Karlala before she sprung into action? Because, you know, they're being bombed by the other side, and they're like, oh no, obviously, like, our enemies are sending us up to die. They're pretending to rescue us, but they realize that, oh, they're trying to kill us. So Maya Ya like springs into action and she's like, all right, we gotta kill our way out of here because if we don't, we're gonna die on this craft. But Carla La is like, no, we have to stay here and try to communicate with these aliens. It's the only way that both of us, any of us are going to survive. And she springs into action and gets killed in the escape attempt. And, like, you can feel Carla La being like, no, if only, isn't this the whole point? If we had only communicated with each other, like, I want to communicate with these aliens. This could have all been avoided.
Maybe a lot of what he is saying or portraying is that's a commentary that is running, that so much could be avoided, and that is not simply a concept that is only here. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, so much of what Tomino works on is about sort of the not the futility of war, but the wastefulness of it,
mm-hmm.
of human lives and resources and everything, that, like, we could have avoided all of this almost easily.
Well, yeah, like, once again, the classic example is, like, at one point they're like, all right, let's try to get a ceasefire, so we'll throw up a white flag. That's a universal sign for everybody of, let's stop hostilities and talk. And so they throw up a white flag, and the Buff Clan people are like, oh! Essentially, it's them, the middle finger, like, come at me, bro! And you're like, what? We were almost about to go to peace, but then they throw up the white flag? All right, let's bring it. All right, humans, let's go. And then Carla La's like, no, you fools. What do you call it? I thought you wanted peace. And they're like, yes. She's like, no, that's the symbol for hate.
But at the same time, it almost feels like the Buff Clan, at least some of the Buff Clan, is really using any excuse to do anything, because they correct their mistake and then they're like, we're just going to pretend that we didn't notice it.
And, or other people are like, oh, it's obviously a trap. Now that they're losing, they want to pretend to be peaceful so when we lower our guns, they can shoot us. Don't worry. We're not going to fall for it.
And that's also kind of understandable. That's a understandable position, except that everyone on the Buff Clan sucks, so you don't really feel like siding with them, except for Carla, who's fine. There is a bit of an attempt at ceasefire here, and that's why I want to get back to Bess for a minute, who for some reason is really into that for 5 minutes, and then he must have got knocked on his head off camera, and then comes back, because eventually he gets back to his usual, like, just take them all out!
I got a feeling that, like, Bess was like, man, I think Carla La is really hot.
I think that is clear.
Maybe these Buff Clan people aren't so bad, and we can have peace with them. Nope! They're all evil, except for Carla La, who I still want to bone.
I don't think he ever thought that, Al. I think he always just was trying to impress her.
Mm-hmm.
And then was like, oh, they're trying to kill her. Oh, I hate them. I hate them. They're bad. Bad. We'll protect you. And then the other interesting character, actually, in these three episodes, I thought was Kasha, because she kind of goes from... She's still very inexperienced, but she's ready to, like, kill everyone, which I wasn't really expecting.
Yeah, like, after a while, they're like, oh, man, we all gotta hold back Junkyard Kasha. She's on the rampage again. And she's like, I'm gonna sink these motherfuckers.
Yeah, she's becoming kind of space racist and just wants to, shoot first, ask questions later. But at the same time, she's now really dedicated to learning to pilot. So I'm very interested in her fate in here. And It's sort of unclear at this moment if it's being portrayed as her being a crazy emotional lady. But that possibility is certainly on the table, I have to say, unfortunately.
I will say, though, that, like, I'm still a little confused, like, what Cosmo's deal is. Like, because we were talking about him last episode, and like, all right, he seems to be, like, breaking through and, like, beginning to... But he's really, like, kind of, like, I don't want to say passive, but he's a lot, like, on board with other people's... like, he's a real supporter character for other people's, like, movements. But I've never seen him, like, express his own agenda or opinions. It just seems like someone's like, here's a plan. And Cosmo's like, I'm on board with that plan. And then somebody else will have a plan. I'm on board with that plan.
Unless it's Kasha's plan.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt as though the only time we've seen him really express himself seems to be in reaction to her so far. And... yeah, otherwise, I still don't feel like I have a sense of him. And it still doesn't feel like he's the main character. I kind of figure the Ideon is actually the main character. Mm-hmm. And speaking of it,
you guys gotta
bring up the Buff Clan's legend that Carla tells them. Because she goes to this whole thing about how, you know, their clan thinks that this robot is their legend, the Ide, and the god of Ide, and you assume that they have a really good reason for believing that, but the legend that she tells, while not a strange legend, I mean, it seems like, you know, mythology, but why they think this robot is the dude in that legend who ate that magical devil fruit, I have no idea.
I was rewatching because I was like falling asleep a little bit during the last episode, so I was rewatching it. I think what we're missing is the humans are looking for the Ideon and then they found it. The Buff Clan is looking for the Ide, which is like a little more abstract. It's like the power source of the Ideon. And I think, once again, it could be a little Tomino confusing. I think they're searching for something a little beyond just the Ideon. I think they think the Ideon is something that taps into this larger idea of the Ide.
Oh, I see what you mean. Almost like the fruit, the magic.
Yeah.
The magic inherent in that.
Yeah, and that the Ideon is just like a super good way of getting to that thing that's beyond the Ideon, this Ide, this infinite power.
Interesting. I had sort of convinced myself that my joke from the first time we talked about this was not so fake, and the guy in that legend is inside of the Ideon, just in an Ava-esque move.
I mean, that might be the case.
I mean, because the thing that keeps me thinking about that is the way that the Ideon keeps making decisions or doing things that seemingly are sentient things, but it could be caused by other sources and other people's emotions, and especially if there's some sort of magic space power going on, which Tomino was not above magic space power, so...
What are you talking about, Kate? You make it seem like, say, Camille would start channeling space voodoo to have the Zeta have more magical powers.
I would never imply that. Ever. Except when I did and wrote it down. Yeah, so, okay, that's an interesting... Maybe I should go back also and rewatch the legend that she tells. Because it seemed just almost, like, so laughable at the time.
Because that's why they weren't so concerned about getting the Edion at first. Because I think what they're really searching for is the E-Day. Whereas the humans are only kind of just learning about the E-Day right now. So,
well, I don't think they have any interest in it. I think it's the technology itself that's so interesting to them.
When Cheryl is using that, like, interrogation machine, Cosmos is like, ha! Infinite energy, you say? Well, that would be super useful.
Oh, I forgot about the interrogation scene. That's true. I mean, we don't actually, now that you mention it, we don't really know very much about why they have gone out to explore this part of space, do we?
They're trying to start colonies because humanity has just gotten the ability to jump outside of their galaxy. And so they've only been here, I think it said, for like 60 years.
It was interesting that they finally did mention, though, in one of these episodes that they have met other alien races, but apparently none of them looked like humans because they were so thrown off. I think we mentioned before that the Buff Clan looked like humans, but then in a recent episode they mentioned that they were not the first alien species that they've run into. So
this might seem that I am going on a weird tangent, but it'll be important. So, I was recently reading an interview with one of the main guys on Super Robot Wars and Kaneko Nasu. And so, it was mostly focused on the Super Robot Wars games, but they talked a little bit about series that have gone into Super Robot Wars and then mecha in general. One of the interesting things that came up in that interview was people started showing me anime stuff. And so I watched the original Gundam trilogy of movies, and I was super moved. I was, like, so, like, in awe by the third movie that, like, I didn't want to leave the third Gundam movie, that I didn't want to, like, leave the theater. I was, like, so hit by it. And when I got back, one of my friends who had, you know, suggested I watch it was like, all right, you've done the beginning, Tomino. And that's a good start. But now I have a show for you that's the real Tomino. It's called Edion. That really got me thinking about Edion's place in, you know, the Mecha pantheon. Because like we mentioned in the last episode, it was like such a big plot point in Shirobako. And then there's that new series, I forgot what it's called, by the guy who does Mysterious Girlfriend X, where this kid goes back in time and meets his mom, and she, like, introduces him to, like, Edipon and, like, shows him the theme song, and it's, like, an off-brand version of Edion. And I was like, wow, this series has, like, so much more of a resonance with, like, the hardcore otaku than I originally had thought. And so it's like, once again, it's giving me a lot more, like, I really do feel like this is more than just the show that random nerds go, oh, and it was an inspiration to Evangelion.
What you're saying is that now we get to be the real otaku.
Yeah.
Is that right? We're on our way?
Yeah, we're going to unlock the real Tomino,
oh,
Kate.
Oh, man, I've always dreamed of being a real otaku.
Kate, we might even, after we finish this, be able to get into that rare club, the real mecha fan.
I don't want to be a member of that club. And neither do you. All right, so to kind of wrap it up, because I might not talk about it again for a little bit. I know I have been talking about One Piece a lot. I apologize if you just hate it and don't ever want to hear me talk about One Piece again. I can't help myself. And
but you've been mainlining it.
I have been, and I now have gotten up to the time skip. So the time skip has not... I have not read the moment when the time skip has now occurred. It's like I finished the book right before it happens. So I've gotten through Thriller Bark, Sabaody, Impel Down, Paramount War, the results of the Paramount War. So I'm right there on the precipice of the time skip.
I have a question. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's fine. Was there an incident with a newspaper?
So, yes. Okay, now, I do not know, okay? I cannot figure it out because there's this part where Luffy... All the Straw Hats say after the Paramount War, there's this newspaper that goes out, and all the Straw Hats say that they understand the sign Luffy has given them. They know what to do. And I have no freaking clue. I don't understand. I don't understand the signs. So, yes. So that has happened. But so, I have no idea what's going on.
So you saw the sign, but it did not open up your eyes.
It didn't. I wanted it to so badly, but I have no idea. Especially, I think Robin is the most emphatic about, aha! Mm-hmm, I got this. And I'm like, no! I don't know! So I'm just going to read on, and I'm sure all will be revealed.
I'm going to bookmark that, but we're going to have a conversation about that whole Robin thing.
We totally will. I have so many feelings about Paramount War in particular, but
the build-up to it too as well.
Yeah, I thought, so just to briefly mention Thriller Bark, didn't love it. I liked the setting a lot. I wasn't that crazy about the actual story of it. Although I did really enjoy Zombie Luffy, who takes on all the powers of a bunch of other zombies.
Big Emperor 5, that's always a lot of... The robot scene.
Oh, yeah. So there was some fun moments. But, again, I didn't love the villain. And I really super hated that pervy, invisible ghost man. I was...
Well, I mean, it brought in your least favorite temp Straw Hat crew member. You know, that member that, like, has a temporary position in the crew.
I don't recall.
That, like, temp cook guy?
It's fading. It's fading from memory. I mean, yeah, we have... It was, like, two perverts. Just, no. It's not funny. It's not amusing. I hated every minute of it. Nami getting kidnapped and trying to be married off. All of this. They're only good things. Like I said, Luffy, always good. Usopp was good in this arc. Like, he basically wins by being the most negative person. Definitely a lot of amusing bits to it. But I think it really gets going in Sabaody and then becomes just the greatest in Impel Down. Sabaody, you know, when they get to that archipelago, that's when we first get to see, like, kind of the rest of the world and the way the rest of the world sort of functions, I guess. Because the nobles, and they're heinous and terrible, and there's slavery in this part of the world. So we get kind of a better idea of what they're up against.
And if you want to think about it, you know, just the way you said it made me think about it. What's really messed up and kind of says a lot about the One Piece universe is when you think about it, that means that most what we see of this little part of Sabaody is actually kind of very indicative of a lot of the rest of the world. Because a lot of where One Piece takes places is like the fringe parts of, like, almost like the outsider lands where the law is a lot less restrictive. And maybe you'll run into, like, one or two, like, nice guy kingdoms, like cobras and, you know, with Alabaster. But from what you see, the nobles are in charge in a lot of the settled parts of One Piece land, where once again you have slavery, because that's where the nobles are in charge. Even slightly outsider places, like where Luffy grows up, because you got to that part, right? With
Luffy. Yeah, I got his back, some backstory with him and Ace.
You get once again a lot of very strict social structures, and you know the nobles having way more power than they, you know, should, and being very abusive and being very controlling. And so, like, you get the feeling that, like, there's a lot of reason why, like, the revolutionaries have, like, the support that they do, because places under the thumb of the nobles is really, like, great for the nobles, kind of shit for everybody else.
And I think it shows a lot about piracy and what pirates are trying to do and what they're fighting against, because, you know, of course, pirates are very romanticized, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's just a visual people really enjoy, and we like stories about pirates. Pirates are theoretically criminals, but the way that you see them, I think, after you start seeing what the government and what these nobles and things are like, is really, there's pirates who are revolutionaries who are fighting against a corrupt system. And then there's people who are taking advantage of that and being pirates to sort of sweep up and use that in a negative way.
Or like, hey, I'm horrible, but it's not like the other option is that great. So pick your poison.
And I can be horrible. Mm-hmm. And get away with it in certain instances because of taking advantage of the way that the world is structured. So I thought that was very interesting and kind of, I think, has real world implications. And, you know, One Piece can be really, really smart and thoughtful in certain ways like that, I think. But beyond being super serious, okay, Impel Down, the prison arc is absolutely just delightful on so many levels. Luffy teaming up with all of his old nemesises and running around a prison fighting crazy things and looking for his bro. And I mean, I know that it ends up being really bad and basically this whole war begins, but it's still such a hysterical and so much fun arc to read, especially when Buggy's showing up, Bon Clay. I was telling Al about this offline, but that when Bon Clay showed up, I realized that I'm often confusing the names Bon Clay and Don Flamingo and getting them confused. And so sometimes people are like, Don Flamingo is like so evil. And I'm like, man, what happens to him later? And I'm like, wait, I'm thinking of Bon Clay. It's the feathers, okay? That's what it is.
Man, he makes a hard turn. I mean, yes. He was a villain, but he was usually a nice guy villain.
It was like, he was a villain, but not really. He was a noble sort. And you really see that in Impel Down. Wow. He is a true brother to Luffy. We meet Iva, who is part of Dragon's Revolutionaries. We start to like learn a little bit more about that. Iva is this character who is so great and so problematic at the same time. I'm fascinated by her group of people, but I also feel like it's probably has a lot of caricature and insensitivity.
Well, it's so it doesn't help that. Do you realize what the character design is based on?
I mean, it kind of... Well, go ahead, tell me.
So it's based on Frankenfooter from Rocky Horror, which is a weird, like, super campy already, and, like, So I feel like that just muddies the waters even more and makes it, like, once again, makes it very interesting and then very problematic at the same time.
That's interesting because, it's because her power is I think they call it the Horohoro fruit in English, yeah. But she is able to manipulate hormones, so she was a man, now she's a woman, and she's able to manipulate the hormones in other characters, and then a lot of her group seems to be transgendered, which is so cool, and they're such a cool group of people. But yeah, sometimes I'm like, I think maybe you're doing some really stereotypical jokes and stuff in here that are not sensitive. So it's like progressive sometimes and not in others. But Iva as a character, I'd say beyond her character design and some of the jokes, like the concept of her character is really cool and interesting. And then Crocodile shows up in the prison. Oh, and we meet Jinbei for the first time, which I wasn't expecting. I really was not expecting him to be in here with Ace.
And he's odd because he's a character that is mentioned so early on, because they mention him all the way back when they first bring up the fishmen in when Nami's introduced.
Of course, Buggy steals the show in Impel Down because everyone starts following him and believing in his abilities to change the course of history, basically. And all these prisoners, they keep breaking people out to distract the guards and the warden and just creating chaos in this prison. And Blackbeard shows up here because this is all part of his grand scheme plan, because there are really, really, really scary people at the very bottom of Impel Down that he wants on his crew.
So, just before we get into the Paramount War, because I feel like that's going to eat up a lot of time, I just wanted to make some interesting little comments. I think it's a thing to look for that I didn't mention, because, you know, you hadn't read up to that part, is start looking at the member of Blackbeard's crew and how they have parallels between them and members of Luffy's crew. You can then go, who doesn't he have yet? Because those are people, obviously, because I really feel like they're building up, once again, Blackbeard to be the anti-Luffy, so all of his crew members are basically anti-Straw Hats. You'll also notice that they all have a distinct fate theme. Each of them is very tied to, this happens because of fate, and Luffy's are all about will and determination, you know, making your choices. Since you kind of went through Sabaody really quickly, what did you think of, the other up-and-coming pirate guys?
Oh, all the other pirates?
Because I feel like they're like one of the other really interesting, because all of them, as the series goes on, are either really important or you know they're going to be important.
I'm super interested in Drake, mostly because his power is like a dinosaur power or something. And as soon as I saw this, I thought, why is no one talking about this? And maybe there's a reason. But
not to be too spoilery, he's the one who has come up in conversation a few times, but he's actually one of the few of them who has not super duper re-entered the plot.
So that's probably why, because I saw that and I was, I'm in! Who are you? Tell me now! So that was really interesting. A lot of strong personalities. The one that's throws me off the most is the one that's like Al Capone or something. It's like
He is really important in the current arc.
That was weird. Kid, of course, interesting. Trafalgar Law, I am so curious about his power. Because we see it a little bit when the crew gets split up and they're all in this desperate struggle in Sabaody. And we get to see just a little taste of it. And I'm really curious about what it is and how it works. And since I know that he's super popular, I'm sure he'll be around for us to figure that out.
All those characters, like the minute you see all of them and all that goes down, they just scream, plot seed, plot seed, plot seed, plot seed.
I will mention, since we're back to Sabaody for a minute, is that when they fight one of the admirals there that we're basically seeing for the first time and just, like, get totally decimated, even though I knew that everything would be okay, it was really, really sticky situation. I was legit concerned about characters' well-being and thought certain characters could have died. And the fact is that the end of the way that it ends when they all get separated feels like such an ending. I just imagine Oda, I don't know what happened that week, but I can only imagine if you were a reader, a weekly reader, that you would have just lost your mind. And then Oda goes on vacation for a month or something. He's like, I'm just gonna take a break now. Like, no! You can't! Everybody needs to know what's happening because it made it look like the crew died.
I swear he at least went on a week vacation.
That is so cruel. If only Sanji had died. They really make it look like it's so... Don't tease me like that. Don't do that, okay? I dream of this often. That's not cool to put it, like, on the table as a possibility and just snatch it away.
I just noticed that you skipped it's a small arc, but you just went over Amazon Island like it never existed.
Well, I guess I sort of saw it as, it's just this really, like, short intermediary arc.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
like I said, it isn't, like, the longest, most important arc. Although, for some people, it introduces the most importantest character who ever did important character.
I mean, I definitely...
And her two sisters.
I definitely don't... I started the arc really disliking her. And I was basically Luffy, who was really did not like her. And then I better understood her. So it was all right. And she does help smuggle Luffy into Impel Down. But, you know, like, I like that Luffy has no, as a character, him not being interested in her or interested in just the concept of love or anything, just it feels right and good, and I'm fine with the way things are. I do not want them to change. So as long as they don't change, it's okay.
I always wished Rebecca had joined the crew, even though, like, part of me always knew, she just seems a little too underpowered to be somebody who would join up. And she just seemed like a helper character.
She was the entry point character, basically. Now, can I talk about Paramount Orc?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
I
no.
I'm not sure that I can without getting very emotional.
I was like, you know, I feel like if I don't bring it up, like, Amazon arc is just gonna completely just, like, get just be like, that means Bo Hancock and her boobs. All right, let's move on.
I mean, you said it, not me. Paramount War, it's almost unfairly good because the rest of the crew is not there. And so it's so good. I mean, it is so unbelievably powerful, emotional, amazing, and yet the rest of the crew is not there, and it almost makes me feel a bit like a traitor that it's the best it's ever been.
So, you know, before we move on, you know, we were having this discussion on the last podcast, where we were going to Otakon, we've kind of had a running dialogue about this. Now that you said it, really, sparks into my head that why do you think that, like, you have not seen that much discussion of this, considering, in your opinion so far, this is the high point of the series that you've seen?
Yeah, the only thing I really knew going into this was Ace's death, that would happen.
Like, and it seems odd that, like, that you figured that's the, like, I mean, you know, once again, people like to run around saying Spike dies and stuff like that. But you figured, you know, the a-holes are going to mention that. But it seems like even the, like, not people who love going around spoiling people, that's the only thing you hear about that arc. And then, like, otherwise, it seems almost like, oh, yeah, it was one of those uneventful things, but you got to read it because Ace dies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was really presented to me that way, but yeah, I didn't think it would be a nothing, but I feel as though it's not a named arc that I had ever heard of.
You know,
I hear about these other ones. We've talked about them. Alabaster and, Baroque Works, Skypiea, Thriller Bark. You know, you hear these names and you know that they're this big thing that happened or whatever. And so I think it's very interesting. Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know if it's... I really don't understand it, because... Maybe it is because the rest of the crew is missing, and it just is, wow. It has these incredible fights, of course, but Luffy trying to get to Ace, Whitebeard trying to hold things together and rescue Ace and take on the frigging entire Navy, them trapping them. There's a giant that comes and, like, is related to, you know, a character from Thriller Bark, and people are dying and really brutal stuff is going on. The three admirals are the scariest dudes. Their powers are crazy. And that fire admiral is the bastardest bastard whoever bastard. God, that guy is horrible.
Yeah, I feel like up until this point, Oda was like, you know, I've had some characters you really could hate and are scumbags, but I've been saving this guy in my back pocket.
It's huge, too. I feel like it's this epic battle and highs and lows and all the emotions. And when Luffy gets to Ace! He gets him! And for a brief second, you know, I thought, oh, everyone was just lying! It's gonna be fine! They're together! They're gonna get out of this! And when Ace tells Luffy, you know, thank you for loving me, and just the saddest brother thing! Oh my god, it was so good! And then Whitebeard gets betrayed, but then he just can, like, go on and get stabbed, like, 1,000 times and get hit by 60 cannonballs or what the frick ever, and barrels through the whole time. And, you know, Jinbei also really doing some cool stuff in here. He's essential, all the whales showing up. Crocodile being all noble villain, like, all right, I got my beef with you guys, but I hate the Navy way more, so I'm not gonna kill you right now. Yeah, that was awesome. Crocodile, he solidified himself as my favorite villain.
But yeah, I feel like, because this also came up on the train to Otakon, that I feel like you still get the feeling that Crocodile is a dick and a son of a bitch.
Oh, totally.
There is no redemption arc. He is totally 100% an ally of convenience. And everybody on, like, both sides realizes, like, the minute this, that we are both not in mortal danger, you are not somehow, like, some nice guy who's going to be helping orphans after this shit.
Totally not, but that doesn't diminish just some of the cool saves that he does in this arc. I think that the series portrays everybody's personalities totally right in here. That Croc, because Crocodile is smart, unlike the villains of many of the other arcs. He's smart. He knows. He has a, you know, he's got a, he's able to see ahead. So he knows this is the moment that I can use to my advantage. I'm not getting out of here alive if I don't do this thing. You know, he's being intelligent about it. So, no, I don't think, now Crocodile's gonna be Team Luffy or something. But he's like, just like the teensiest bit noble a little bit when he does some saving in here. Because he could, I could argue, though, that he could let characters die. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to help them. He can fight against the Navy and not necessarily help them, but he does. So, again, that's because he's trying to save his own skin. But I feel like you could like, argue just, like, a smidgen. Maybe he has, like, a sliver of, you know,
decent guy.
Decent, like, honor. Like, just a little teeny bit. Buggy, of course, sensational in this arc. He is providing all the comic relief because Luffy actually does not really provide any comic relief in this arc. And I wonder if Oda really thought that through, because Luffy's still pretty funny in Impel Down because he's so nonchalant about breaking into the biggest, highest security prison in all the world. But here, Ace's life is on the line and Luffy is in, like, totally so serious mode that he really doesn't have that sort of, like, hilarious streak. And so Buggy and his minions, and he gets on the snail TV or whatever and broadcasts to the world. And they're all, like, watching him going, why do we have to see this guy? Can't we see the rest of them? You know, the war, what's going on? So Buggy just, like, killing it. And although that does bring up, you know, one of the other serious points in here is about how the government manipulates the media and is only broadcasting certain things and actually shuts off the broadcasting at certain points to make Whitebeard look bad and to manipulate how the public sees the war. Again, very real world relevant concept there. So yeah, the Paramount War, I felt like it had everything except it didn't have, you know, the rest of the crew. And maybe that's what sort of prevents it from from being quite the, but I, to me, it's like top notch that, ew.
But also it brings up, what do you call it? I think it really raises the Blackbeard threat level through the roof.
Whoa. I mean, and then Blackbeard versus Whitebeard, and Whitebeard's power is super, so crazy dangerous. And then Blackbeard showing that we knew that he could take on other people's devil fruits, but the way that it happens in here is super mysterious, and so you just don't know exactly, like, what's going on. He's such an unknown, and yeah, I just felt like the threat level on everything was so turned up to 11 here that it was so big. Unbelievable.
Importantly brought, like, it was a big switch because you know, I feel up until that point, there was always the joke that nobody dies in One Piece. Mm. And the fact that you had such significant named characters, like, so, like, there is no ambiguity. These characters are dead. D-E-A-D.
We see gravestones and memorials for characters at the end, at the very end. The other thing is that we learn a lot. We also learn a ton in these, in this arc, or we get to, or we start to get hints about things, because in Sabo Dee we met Gold Roger's first mate, who's still alive, and so, like, that's really important. And then for the Paramount War, you know, you're kind of sitting there going, like, how can this finish? How do we end this? And Shanks shows up, and it's basically like, hey, this is over. And everyone's like, okay, cool. Yeah, it was cool. It's over. It's over. It's over. Yeah, yeah, it's over. And so you finally have, you still don't know, but you have a sense of, like, shit, man, Shanks is,
for reals,
he is high level, because he doesn't actually fight, he just shows up, and everyone's like, we're cool, we're just cleaning up here, we're done doing
this. Both sides are just gonna go home and lick the wounds, it's good.
We're finished. So I feel like that's very interesting. We get a little bit, Dragon's not here, but he kind of, Iva and Dragon and Jinbei and Kuma, freaking what the freaking freak, I don't know what that is. Scary death giants or whatever. Just so many really big seeds. Again, kind of like in Sabo Dee, there was all these seeds about what's going to be coming. And in here, we have a lot of big things happening, but we also have a lot of, like, what is that? What does that mean? What is that going to mean later? And you know that it's going to be big. So, yeah, it's like almost like hard to keep track of everything. And amidst Ace's death, which is so devastating, I've never seen Luffy so upset. And then later, when he's grieving and just cannot pick himself up, and he's also worried about the crew, and he's, like, talking about how he's failed everyone, and, you know, Luffy is just this positive, buoyant character, so it's almost like it feels so much worse coming from him because of his
person. If he had always been an emo character, it would have been like, alright.
I mean, it would have been still really sad and devastating, but it's just so, it's, like, hard to, it was really hard to read. I cannot watch Luffy. I now know that I cannot see Luffy cry and I not cry also. It's just impossible because of the kind of character that he is. Unless he's just doing that tear thing because there's, like, a big piece of meat. But, yeah, like, kind of the come down, and I thought they did, like, such an interesting job in that era. I thought they did a really nice job with him grieving, and the process of that was really good. Like I said, I do not freaking know what the freaking newspaper thing means. We also get, oh, of course, just to devastate you more,
because you're like, I cannot finish off. I gotta,
it's like, oh my god, I can't even take Luffy crying and blaming himself and being so upset. Oh, let us have a flashback arc to when Luffy and Ace are children. No. No, Oda, no. You should not do this to us, to anyone. It's too hard. But like you said, Al, that part's very interesting because you really didn't have a sense of, Luffy's island being this divided place where there was this walled city of nobles and sort of the trash people. And, you know, it seems so kind of idyllic at the beginning of the series. The seaside town. But the underbelly of that is, you know, very different. And then, you know, through that, we just get to see what kind of a character Ace is as a kid. And I don't understand, though. I'm so interested in Dragon at this point because I really don't understand him. And I really don't know why he has left Luffy alone, especially because he does know certain things are going on. He does show up at certain points, but does not intervene, even when he's a kid. And I kind of really question that. And of course, you know, manga parents, not always the best parents, but I'm very interested in his motivations for how he's treated his family, I suppose, I guess.
You know, I think it'd be very interesting just because he's very clearly tapped into that, like, D-legacy that, like, they keep just teasing. And I feel like that...
Holy shit! I forgot to mention the most important thing! Well, not the most important thing. But Ace's father!
Oh, right, yeah, I guess that's important.
You know what, though? Knowing who Ace's dad, like, finding that out, which I did not know. I didn't know that. But I was thinking, again, as I tried to imagine myself as a reader when it was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you must have thought, plot armor for sure. Oh, now this is who his dad is? Well, he's going to be fine. There's no way that Ace can die. You are wrong. I just feel like that's what I would have thought. I would have thought safe.
Or I think a lot of people for the longest time thought that Gold Roger was going to be Luffy's dad.
Yeah, that, I mean, that seems pretty typical of what you would expect.
And so people were like, what?
Also with that, with Ace's story though, Oda proves that he's not really sure about the female anatomy, not quite clear on how it works.
He should maybe, like call home and ask his wife every once in a while.
It's like, Oda, women cannot keep babies in their wombs for extended periods of time just to, like, hide them from people. That's not a thing!
Look,
that's
Kate,
not a thing!
That was obviously her devil fruit power.
Okay, maybe
the you womb could be... Womb.
The womb womb fruit. Like, but it was... That was super crazy. But yeah, sorry. Back to, the, like, the D-legacy. You know, up until we meet Blackbeard, though, I kind of thought, oh, the D-people are all good people, but... Nope. Certainly not true.
Yep. I wonder once again if Blackbeard could have been on like it would have been easy for him to be on the good path, but he's like, nope. Throw him a lot with evil.
I have a lot of thoughts about Blackbeard, but I'm going to save them for maybe when we talk about One Piece again, because we will. I'm really... just emotionally blown away. I did have to take a break, but I've only got like 20 books.
Nothing.
In the grand scheme of it, it's really not that much. Yeah. So I'm really hopeful that by Christmas time I will be current.
I just want to bring back before we end this my bookmark, which is, all right, so I think you can figure out that all the Straw Hats have to undergo little training arcs, and Luffy will get the lion's share of it, and you'll see a little bit of everybody else's training arc during the time skip. So, I mean, there's some interesting ones, you know, Zoro with, you know, who becomes his trainer, and, you know, Nami is definitely in an interesting place. Most of the characters ended up in, like, really interesting places. But, like, Franky is basically just playing around in a crazy lab. Or Nami is her stealing slash learning from all these cloud...
Mostly stealing
from all these cloud wizards. Because that's what Nami's do.
Yes.
But you can, like, 60 to 90% see in your head most of these people's training arcs. I mean, as cool as it is, Zoro training with Mihawk, you can see about 90% of how that goes in your head.
I also have to... I do not freaking know why Perona is there, and I just have to assume that it launched a bunch of weird ships. Just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, she has, like, a... I can't even say strangely, but she has, a, like, a pretty devoted, although not huge, fan following of people who just... I wonder how much it was just, like...
It's her design.
Yeah.
Period.
But the one character who... They basically like, we don't have to really talk about their arc. And why dwell on that? It's probably super boring. You can play it out in your head. It's Robin's.
I don't know why. I wonder if Robin seems sort of like the character that Oda wishes he hadn't introduced sometimes.
Because, I mean, you've seen it. But she basically goes off and, like, does missions with the Revolutionary Army for these 2 years. And you know shit happens during that. That's, like, amazingly interesting. And they've even hinted at it is. But they're like, you know, stuff. Don't worry about it.
I guess we need another Water 7 for it to be revealed what Robin did.
But it just seems like... This is the one other than Luffy's that really needs some detailed explanation. And I was like, don't worry about it. It's cool. Stuff happens. Things. Stuff. This episode's food for thought.
Okay, so food for thought is... Next year is Otakon's 25th anniversary year. The 20th year, they really went all out, so we don't know yet if what they're going to be doing for 25. We don't know if it's going to be big, whatever. But let's pretend it is, and what would be your one wish for the 25th year?
Listen to our song!
You're fine.
what's your answer to the food for thought?
All right, so our question was, if you could pick one thing for Otakon's 25th anniversary, what would it be? You know, event or, you know, anything that you'd like to see there? So we have a couple answers from Twitter. They're actually the same answer, so I'm just going to read both names. So we got Antonis Plus and Isandra, and they both said a fourth day. So I feel like people ask Otakon pretty regularly to add another day to the convention. And I think that's an interesting idea to do on a limited basis. That's kind of a cool idea.
You know, I think that is an interesting idea to play around with their 30th. And not that I'm totally rejecting it, but I feel like with just the way things have gone, they've only just, like, started to settle in. And I feel like a fourth day is so much more money. Everybody could be talking up Otakon 2017, and they could see a huge uptick in 2018. But I wonder if in this kind of, especially after the way they've, downtrended the last few years.
And we still don't know the numbers for
this year. That I feel like, while it's a cool idea, I don't feel like 2018 is the time to roll that out.
I see what you're saying with all your logic.
But, like, if, like, the numbers, you know, if what we, like, predict and hope that, like, you know, it's just up, 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 up for the next, you know, 5 years, then, you know, the 30th anniversary, I could definitely see them trying that out. Or at least making it like, you know, 30th celebration, 4 days, woo!
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to see it permanently be 4 days. And so I like the idea of just for an anniversary year, it would be. That way they can scale it back from there. But as just a bonus treat, I think that's a really cool idea. For 25 or for 30. What do you want, Al?
Okay. So, we have what I'd love, and then what I'd constructively like to see.
Okay, so the first one is Type Moon comes.
Yes, okay. Done. So, got it out of the way. Something that I think would be realistic. So, I've got two things. One, I'd like to see, I think, you know, 25 years, such an iconic year. I think, and mentioned in the Con report, that at least the general impressions, that it would be really good if they could bring like a blockbuster guest. So I'm thinking one of three people would be really good. Number one, since we just mentioned it, if they could get Oda over here, I mean,
oh my God, don't even.
I mean, I feel like it's still the strongest, the one of the, you know, big Shonen Jump three that's still chugging along. What a coup would that be?
Oh my God.
I mean, you wouldn't need any other, like, all the other guests would just be like, oh, also rans of, like,
wow, that would be crazy.
I mean, you'd really, like, need Viz, like, helping you along with that one, but
this is the wish list.
Yeah.
So, yes.
I think a little more possible, but actually might even be more of a hit if they could get him over, would be the author of My Hero Academia, considering how big that is. I don't know how busy his schedule is. And, you know, he's doing one of the more popular weekly Jump titles. He's still a little pie in the sky, but I feel like if you brought him over, that would be like a real, like a huge amount of buzz. And actually might draw out a little more of the kiddies than maybe even Oda would. I mean, not that, once again, I feel like Oda might bring in a little older just for how long One Piece has been running. But I feel like the author of My Hero Academia is like the hotness right now. So what, it's cooled off, but I feel like you'd see the, you know, kind of like how when they brought over the author of Naruto to New York Comic Con, you're like, eh, I don't feel like people are that into Naruto anymore. But when we went, and you just saw the reaction. So I feel like if they could get the author of Attack on Titan, I feel like that property has cooled, but I feel like you'd still see a lot of the passion if they were able to bring him over here.
As far as guest-wise, I agree that I think they always go for blockbuster, especially in these anniversary years, like 20th was crazy. But when I kind of think about guest-wise, I feel as though I almost want less of the new hotness and something that's sort of, like, classic and forever. Like, what if you got Naoko Takeuchi of, Sailor Moon?
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if she's, you know, under, strict deadlines anymore, but, like, that would be crazy. So I wonder, I'd love to see something kind of tying into almost like the history portion of, obviously Otakon's been around a long time, and obviously Sailor Moon is just this classic moment.
I mean, they kind of did it with the voice actors this year, but if you could get the power couple of the author of Sailor Moon and the author of Yu Yu Hashiko, because they're married, as like a...
Bam! I think we were talking about that on the train home, that would be crazy insanity. Yeah, that would be really cool.
But not guest-wise, just like a new thing they could add. I think that if they could do something, especially since the DC Convention Center seems a little more amiable to outside food, if they could do something like they did with Waku Waku, like have like a little bit of a like Asian food court, just to test it out and see how it goes. Once again, convention centers always have a little bit of, you know, problem with, you know, competition for the in, you know, the in convention center food courts, and especially since they seem so accommodating to what they have.
Plus, they had had Japanese food available.
But I wonder if, since it seemed like they could get them in, I wonder if they could make some other kind of deals. I feel like that could be, you know, maybe like, you know, have businesses or vendors who are amiable to the convention center, or have done deals with the convention center before, and just like work out some kind of deal. I think that would be interesting.
And delicious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It would be cool, too, if they did that and somehow you could buy some sort of pass or something. Like, you could buy a la carte, but then if you bought some sort of, like, special pass, you could try something from each one. Or some sort of, like...
I just wonder how much that has to... How much that would eat into the... You know, they're trying not to make tickets because of taxes, or would that have to be like a separate ticket and thereby you know, throw on the taxes? But you know, if you get like, you know, the, you know, foodies pass or something, you know, hey, sure, you have to pay an additional bunch of taxes and stuff, but you get to, you know, basically go in there and, you know, get a bunch of food, so it, you know, balances itself out. And maybe, what do you call it? Maybe a few kitties wouldn't go undernourished this weekend. The weekend. But then they just drink nothing but ramen and basic ramen, so they don't. Who knows?
They find some way to be malnourished, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
As far as what I'd like to see, I think I'd like almost like the Super Saiyan version of the art exhibits that they've had in the past. And they didn't have one this year, which we talked about, which we'll talk about a little bit. But I really loved when they've brought over concept art, when the Kenshin mangaka was there. They had some original manga pages and just different exhibits. So I'd love to see a huge... It's always very small. Very, very tiny little exhibit, which is cool. I mean, I love it. But I'd love to see some sort of massive exhibit.
I mean, this is just crazy town. And, you know, you'd actually have to get it. But, you know, if we're in imagination land, imagine they had gotten somebody like, or they do get somebody like Oda or the My Hero Academia guy. And since, you know, that would require a lot of coordination with Viz and Shonen Jump, they just brought over like a Jump collection as the, that would be.
That'd be unbelievable. That would be crazy. Yeah. And it'd be different than, say, Viz. A lot of times at Comic-Con and stuff has the signboards display, which is, I mean, that's awesome in and of itself. But yeah, just, I'd love to see some sort of massive either manga exhibit or anime exhibit or some sort of, like, history, you know, cells and just all kinds of stuff. Or if it was stuff, this could be cool, too. Kind of like how they have the Otakon Museum, which is, they collected a lot of that from one person, but people were donating stuff to that. If there was some sort of, like, otaku exhibit where people donated...
Well, have you seen that one guy, I forgot who he is, he's like an industry, American industry person, who's like trying to collect all the magazines that he can.
Yeah.
And like digitize them so they don't, you know, just get lost to the, and like all the advertising and stuff like that, like if they could like talk to him and have a, you know, some kind of like digital gallery.
Yeah, I mean, that would be super cool. Or if maybe they could get donations from Otakon members and people who come to like put up some sort of gallery, I think that would be really, really awesome for memorabilia and stuff. The other thing that I think is completely impossible, but I don't care because people are asking for a fourth day, which is just as impossible as about what I'm about to say, but I think it would be really cool because we've gotten to see a lot of different stuff from Japan, but I'd love for them to bring over a stage play, like one of the anime stage plays, and like actually like get a basically a performance, like maybe like two night, you know, like Friday night and Saturday night, like you could get like an actual stage play performance of some
The Prince of Tennis musical, yeah, or
whatever.
Something,
whatever, you know, like I think that would just be like bonkers and cool and crazy. And like I said, I don't think that's just like the amount of money involved in doing something like that would just, I think, would be insane. But like, say, instead of getting a musical act, like, that could be something really, really...
So they'll bring over the Fake Grand Order stage show, right?
I would see it. Whatever they brought, I would see it. It's just too rare of an opportunity not to.
All I could imagine is, you know, why not shoot for the super moon, Kate? Not just shoot for the moon.
You wanted to bring Taka Rozuka over?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Sure. And they will perform Rose of Versailles. Done.
The super... You're going all the way to Jupiter, Kate.
Yes, I am. But yeah, I think something... Like some sort of live performance that isn't music, I think would be really awesome. So...
But the most fascinating news and conversations from this month.
So, of course, our second half of the podcast is going to be dedicated to Otakon. We're doing this part a little bit longer, and you've probably noticed that the ongoing investigation section was a little bit shorter in order to accommodate it. So, again, if you didn't listen to our pre-Otakon podcast or, you know, read our post, or if you weren't at Otakon, this is Otakon's first year in Washington, D.C. They've moved from Baltimore, and everybody was kind of going in with some expectations that maybe things weren't going to quite fit right. It wasn't going to be a flawless year. Not that any con ever has a flawless year, but I feel like there was a lot of trepidation going in.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people were like, I'm going to sit on the fence and I'm going to see how it goes. Like, basically, if you're going to go, report back to me. Or, you know, I'll let the first year be the guinea pigs. We might as well cut to the chase. I think it went pretty well this year. I mean, there were...
I think that's an understatement, actually.
I feel like there were problems. There were transitional problems. But overall, I don't feel they were more than any other... Like you said, they're not any more than any other con has. And I feel like the transition actually, I think really, in many ways, in my opinion, shows exactly why they had to move. And in fact, I think some of the flaws and problems actually show that the con just has a lot more room to grow.
Yeah, I think it was a really amazing year. I feel as though the problems that they had didn't feel like first year, we don't know what we're doing problems. They just felt like, oh, another year, we learn something every year about how to do this, how to do that. There were definitely some logistics that they got to fix, but it almost felt like they were already familiar with the space. It was just kind of impressive, I felt, that things got off to such a good start.
Well, and they even mentioned at Con Feedback that this year was like a test run, and then, you know, next year they're probably going to move around some stuff with the knowledge of how things work when they're in motion as opposed to theoretical.
And I feel the most impressive thing, and everybody felt it immediately, was how much room there was to get around the hallways. Pretty much every room, except I do have a couple, that were big enough that you didn't have to line up hours before a panel or sit through a bunch of panels to get to things. So there was just way more space than was even needed so that you could breathe and get around. A couple choke points, but otherwise you could kind of almost spin in a full circle with your arms out as you walk down a hall.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how much certain people are going to report back or feel like it was underattended. And I think the numbers were down this year. The official numbers haven't come out. But everything seems to, you know, indicate that, you know, it was clearly not a, like, super growth year. But I feel like if people take the right message from this year, Otakon can really grow into that space as opposed to the Baltimore Convention Center, that even when the numbers were down, it felt like stuffy.
Oh my God. It's such a difference, you guys. If you've ever been to Otakon, you wouldn't even recognize it because it was a completely different feeling from the BCC. And I say this as somebody who wasn't really excited about this move. I really liked contributing to Baltimore, and I liked the Inner Harbor, but I was pretty much on board on Thursday. I had already jumped as a traitor over because everything just felt a lot better, and that it would have a home here and it could grow and everybody could fit and it would just be a better con for everyone. I did think it was interesting that on the forums I was reading how some people felt it was too spread out, that there was almost too much space because it was a long distance between some things. You were inside the whole time, but that it could be a long way. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really mind that, but then, you know, some people got on there and said they, you know, had accessibility issues and how this convention center sort of was not as accommodating to people who can't, you know, do the New York speed walk.
And I'm not going to discount it, but I also wonder on a certain level, I mean, the wider spaces and stuff, yeah, I feel like it's a trade-off. Like, and you know, if this gets to, like, New York Comic Con levels filled, maybe then it'll just be the worst of both worlds. But I feel like if I had accessibility issues, and maybe I'm talking, you know, for people that I shouldn't be, but I feel like the wider spaces, like, there just seemed much more room to maneuver. Like, there were so many choke points that I'm sure if you had accessibility issues, must have been a nightmare. Like, that, any of the bridges, I feel like if, you know, heck, for people who didn't have any kind of, you know, deterrent, those were a nightmare. If you, you know, had crutches or a wheelchair or something like that, I'm sure those were terrifying. And I remember people were always complaining because the sky bridge in between the hotel and the BCC, like that elevator for the, what do you call it? The handicap elevator was super slow and was always being used. So I feel like it was a trade-off. And so far, I don't feel like it was the worst.
I think it was more that because there was such a distance between, say, point A and point B, it was hard to go to a lot of things. And then from other friends talking about it, the other thing that came up at Con Feedback was that first floor entrance between the two buildings that crosses the street was not open this year. And so a lot of people had to go into the con, up, across, and then back down. And then that was really hard for people with accessibility issues. Mm. Whereas if that entry was open and then that con, it sounds like the con definitely heard that message. And I have a feeling that entrance will be open next year, or at least open for people who have accessibility passes, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that seems super fair. I mean, you don't need that many guards then, because you only have to really let through anybody with an accessibility pass. And, you know, everybody else can just make the hike. I guess also, it's just, I'm working in a bunch of buildings that are under construction, so I constantly have to, like, dart around, so it's just natural for me to be like, yeah, you know, sometimes you have to go 3 steps backwards and 1 step around to get to where you're going.
Yeah, it didn't really bother me, but I'm, you know, just easily, it's just natural for me to be able to do that. And of course, anybody coming from New York is like, whatever, I have to walk everywhere. This is not big deal. And I actually, you know, loved the layout for the most part. I think there was a lot of confusion because there were good maps. I liked the maps, but because things were so big, you'd look at the map and then you'd go down a hallway and you'd be like, all right, where is it again? So I think they need to kind of update the signage with more, this way's, is this sort of street sign stuff?
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like people suggest this every year. It's like, street signs that say, this way, this is the dealer's room, that away is panel 6 or whatever. And it's never, ever happened. So I don't know what the hurdle is, like, why that can't happen. But I feel as though even in the BCC, this was something that people asked for constantly and never got. So I don't know what about that is not working or not, like, workable, I guess.
You know, the other thing I saw somebody in the forums complaining that there was no food around the convention center. Essentially, they literally complained, oh, there was no, like, good places to eat 2 or 3 blocks away. I sometimes had to walk 4 or 5 blocks.
I was amazed by how close and good all the food was.
I'm like, is it just because we're New Yorkers and we're used to walking? Or is it like, you know, are we just like the long distance runner and everybody else is like, sorry, you've trained for this your whole life?
But we found multiple places that, like, there was Bold Burger really close to our hotel. That good sandwich place was right out of the convention center.
Yeah, I know. It's just, I felt like there were a lot of choices of places to eat. And like you said, the map sometimes looked a little far away. But I feel like once you actually got there, you got stuff pretty quickly.
You mean the Google map?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thrown off by the map that I made because I don't know why, but yeah, the way it looked, it seemed as though the distance was really far. Maybe it was because the blocks weren't as long or something, but it didn't end up being particularly long walk anywhere. Yeah, certainly less than in Baltimore, I felt.
And we were able to go to a supermarket and really double down on our rations, which was nice.
That was, like, my favorite thing.
I mean, you were so well stocked that you barely left the convention center once the con started.
Yeah, actually, that's probably the most dangerous thing that happened. So we stayed at the hotel that was connected to the con, which I don't know if I've ever done that, except maybe at, like, a very small convention. So I haven't never done it for Otakon. And, oh my god, it was so amazing. But I literally did not go outside till Sunday. We had gotten there on Thursday, so so, you know, maybe that's not the best thing to do, but hey, that's what happened. I was able to do that because I had groceries.
Yeah, no, I mean, I went around a little bit and I picked up some stuff for people once or twice, but I feel like, yeah, no, it was pretty convenient that way. So the area, I felt like, was pretty good. But how about the con itself?
Was the con good?
Yes.
It was good.
Yeah.
It was a good con. I really got to go to a lot of panels this year. And again, I think that was sort of a function of just being able to get in. There, you don't want panel rooms to be half empty, but it is really nice for panel rooms to be a little bit too big for whatever is in there so that people can just show up, go into them, check things out, even if it's not for the full time, and be able to get to do other things. I've really felt that this year. I don't have to line up early or go early to get to this panel. And I realized that when I saw how much I did on Friday.
You know, I feel like, did you not get into anything? The only thing I didn't get into was a Fate's Day Night panel, which was in panel room 6.
That was the problem panel room.
Yeah, no, because they had the Fate panel, which I probably would, if I had gone straight there, probably would have gotten into. But I had to see a man about a horse, as it were. So after I'd done all that, the room had filled up. But I feel like you could be... There's no one really to blame to realize that, oh man, Fate's really just gotten popular enough that maybe you should have put in a bigger room. I feel like that's a simple mistake to make and possibly a little unexpected mistake. But the fact that I didn't try to go into this, but I just saw people being turned away from a Voltron panel in that room, and I'm like, ooh, that was not the right room to put that in.
And I saw a lot of panels in that room over the weekend, and all of them were very, very full. Oh, raise your hand if you have an empty seat next to you so that we can get as many people in this room as possible. So I'm really hoping that either they eliminate that room and use a bigger room for panel 6, or...
They make it the niche of niche rooms.
Yeah.
Like the experimental, like, I'm not sure a lot of people are going to go to this panel, but we want to give it a run.
Yeah, because I saw History of Magical Girls in there. I saw a cooking one in there. I saw Shoujo You Should Know in there. And yeah, it really was... It seemed to be too small for everything that was in there. Maybe there were some things over the weekend that fit. But yeah, I think... I noticed at Con Feedback that they were all... Before anybody practically said anything, they were like, we're changing the panel rooms! So it sounds like it was definitely on their radar already. But yeah, that was the problem room. And panel 8 was a weird room because it was in the Marriott. And
I don't think I ever went there.
I went there for one panel. And it was pretty full. And... It almost seemed like they didn't really want to put it there because it was the only one that was in the Marriott. Like, every single thing else was in the Con Center. So, not sure how they'll decide where to put things next year. But they basically said, oh, everything's moving except Dealer's Room and Artist Alley and the Video Game Room. And everything else is up in the air about where it will be.
You know what was also really nice about the con being so wide open? I don't think I, like, got random con funk ever. Like, maybe if I was really, like, directly behind somebody who was super smelly, I'd, you know, get a whiff of odor. But, you know, you've been to the con, and you'll just, like, it'll hit it, and you have no idea where it's coming from. And you're like, I'm not even around anybody. It's just this...
Amorphous cloud
of stank. Yeah. I never got that at the Washington Convention Center.
I did get it once in that hallway that leads to the dealer's room. But that was it. So I agree with you that it was very wide open, so you didn't feel the press of humanity. The only slight downside I felt from the wide openness was that it was freezing in the convention center and Marriott, in my opinion. I saw lots of people complaining that it was freezing in the forums, and then I saw other people going, the AC was perfect, thank you. So, I mean, I acknowledge that I am always cold, but I was wearing a sweater and jeans, and I was shivering pretty much the entire weekend. So that seems a little excessive. Obviously, I don't want it to be warm, and I'm not actually sure how much Otakon has control over the temperature of the convention.
I mean, there was a little speculation, there's a pure speculation, that they were expecting more people, so they had, basically asked them to set the temperature for the number of people they thought. And then maybe it's just... I got the feeling that's really hard to get the convention to change the temperature once it's once they have it, once they've set something. So I wonder if, like, they were like, make it this temperature. And then essentially they're like, maybe we should have had a little higher. You know, the idea is better to err on the side of everybody being a little cold than super sweaty.
Exactly. I can't really fault them for that. Just makes me consider what I will wear next year. Mm-hmm. And that's how cold it was. That I'm seriously considering, the wardrobe that I need to bring because it was so cold. And I wanted to mention that a lot of big rooms had queue rooms or designated
roped off queue areas.
Exactly. So that was a great, great addition, I think. Some of the queue rooms, the way that they filled them was really confusing and weird, especially in the Marriott. It was almost like a maze in order to fill the queue hall, but whatever. I'm just glad that they had them. So very few panels, except from some of the smaller ones, had lines outside in the hallways.
You know what I found weird? And this is just random, just talking about people queuing up. Apparently, there were a bunch of video rooms, and apparently the AMV theater was constantly filled. Which is just like,
I don't even know where that was.
I remember like Jam and a few people like peeking their head into the, or maybe they went to like see the, and they're like, man, the AMV theater is like super filled all this weekend. And I was like, huh? I mean, I know that there's some people really like AMVs. Like I've spoken, like Jefferson, who's commented on the blog a few times, and does some staffing. I know he's talked to me, and like Otakon has a pretty strong AMV community, but it never, at least at Baltimore, seemed like as packed as it was this year's. And
I just wanted to say that there are also panels in there.
Mm.
And they had started doing that the last couple of years in Baltimore. So some of it is panels. And I know some people who had, I think George had a panel in there. So it's also panel music. I don't exactly know, but it's not just,
oh, okay,
running.
I never stepped in there. I was just telling you what I heard. But I went and, like, there was a line of people, a noticeable line of people trying to get into the Lupin the Third Part 1 screening. I think that they had, like, the Sword Art Online movie, which has been out for a little while, and I think you could get one or two places. But as far as I could tell, the room was, like, I peeked in there. I was like, what? Why is this, like, screening room, like, filled? Oh, Sword Art Online movie. And then, like, had to pick up, I, like, randomly was walking somewhere, and, like, had to pick up a girl in a dungeon was, like, 75% filled, and it was a pretty big screening room. Like, next door was a practically empty non-Baka screening room, but it seemed like, for whatever reason, the screening rooms, certain shows were actually quite heavily attended.
It's been a long time since I've been in a screening room. I definitely saw premieres, and in fact, we went to two premieres, which is a little unprecedented in one day at this particular Otakon, but yeah, that's really interesting. It makes me also wonder how full that Lupin 50th anniversary panel, Italian game screening and 50th whatever was filled or not.
Yeah, I mean, if I wasn't doing other things at the time, I would have definitely liked to have popped my head in there just to see what was going on there. That seemed like interesting.
And we saw In This Corner of the World and the first Eureka 7 new movies, they're kind of, think of them as the Ava rebuild of Eureka 7 or something like that.
Yeah, I think there are, so I think, like, I've read one or two things that they're supposed to be kind of a reboot. Maybe they realized that no one should ever acknowledge AO existed. I don't know.
Yes. They acknowledged that themselves at the end of AO. And we're really lucky because that Eureka 7 movie was a world premiere. It hasn't even come out in Japan yet. Only people who had seen it were some industry folks before us, so that was really special. We have mixed feelings about the actual film, but the fact that we got to see it in that manner was really cool.
And although we weren't the first people to see it, I do feel, or even the first Americans to see it in any large number, I do feel like it was a real treat to get in this corner of the world. It was, it was a really powerful movie. It was obviously a movie that had a lot of heart and effort put into it. It did not have an easy path to being made. You know, they suffered a lot of setbacks. They to cross the finish line, they had to get it kick-started. They had to cut, and reduce the grand scope that they originally had, but I feel, despite all those things, the love and the care for that story and the message it tells was super apparent. And it's gonna get a wider release, so I hope people check that one out, because I feel like they've put in a real good amount of effort.
I really liked how the screening room, at least the premieres that we saw, had these three giant screens. And a lot of the panel rooms had multiple screens. So that was a great big improvement, just readability-wise. And I really appreciated it. I did not so much appreciate that in the Marriott the screens were really low and reading subtitles was nearly impossible for anybody under 7 feet tall. So I think they heard the message about that, and hopefully that'll change. We did our panel at 9 a.m. on Friday morning. Basically, we opened the con.
Yeah.
I think I'll put it that way. And since this year the con was Reverse Thieves themed, I thought that was a real nice gesture on their part.
Man, you have such a different interpretation. I'm like, we were the opening act, and everyone's like, get off the stage so we can see the real person we paid to see.
No, we were there. They were saying, this is what Otakon is.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like how they play Otaku no Video at the opening and the closing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly how I'm going to choose to interpret that.
The fundamental difference of our opinions on things showed once again. That does bring in my opinion, one of the flaws that they actually kind of smoothed over as the day, as the convention went on, which was bank check, which as we can tell, some would say, bigger cons had a problem with this year. Shade thrown. and I know that, in our pre-convention podcast, we were like, I don't know, hopefully this will go well. And I feel like Friday was a little bumpy. But I feel already by Saturday.
And even, I think it was only Friday until noon, maybe. Mm. It really cleared out. So I think it was fixed day of. It wasn't even having to wait till the next day for it to... Because I was going in and out a lot throughout the day, going back to the hotel, get something to eat, da-da-da-da. And I really only had... We really only saw a problem right in the morning on Friday, and then it was perfectly fine.
I know some people groused about it, but I feel... and this might be me projecting motives, but I feel like most of the people who were complaining really were people who felt like the bag checks were just completely unnecessary and almost like an affront to their principles, and thereby, like, any amount of wait seemed too long. Because, I mean, even I, who generally feel like a lot of it is security theater, felt like, well, one, it makes a lot of people happier and feel safer. And two, it's kind of, as they mentioned at the con feedback, kind of now just a part of DC, especially in any places where there are large gatherings. And most importantly, I was never so delayed that I missed something or couldn't do something because of it. It merely just seemed like a minor annoyance, but nothing that ever broke my flow.
I agree. It really, again, besides Friday, right when the con opened, it seemed very unobtrusive. A lot of people were worried that they were going to be, you know, questioning things in your bag, but they were literally only looking for weapons or something. You know, they weren't worried about if you had a bottle of water or food or, you know, I think people were really like, oh, is this going to be, you know how sometimes if you're going to, say, Madison Square Garden or whatever, you're like, not allowed to have, like, outside food and drink, and they're, like, looking through your bags for all kinds of stuff. And so I think people were really concerned. It was, it's a con, I need something to eat, and I need these things and whatever, but they really didn't care.
The only thing that almost got me stopped and I had to get, was some lady thought that I had, like, a USB, like, splitter, that it was a little silvery, so she thought it was maybe a knife. And then she, like, picked it up and saw, oh, it's just, like, a USB thing. And she's like, all right, go ahead. And that was 10-20 extra seconds. It was hardly, like, it was, you know, I got taken aside and strip searched. And, you know, lost 2 hours of my time. So I feel like, and I didn't really see, once again, maybe, like, one or two people had questionable objects left over a little bit, but I didn't see anybody, like, really get stopped for more than 30 seconds.
Definitely. So, I wasn't super worried about that, and security overall seemed nice and...
About the only time I saw, like, guards and stuff be a little frustrated was con staff at the gaming room seemed a little upset, but mostly because, and this was a little bit the con's own fault, was they didn't mark which door was in and out, so a lot of people would just go towards the door that they saw in front of them, and you could tell, like, anytime you went to the gaming room about 1:30 in the middle of the day, you could tell the people were a little frustrated about telling people which doors to go in and out of. But, I mean, they didn't, like, scream at anybody. It was just like, yeah, it's one of those things that next time, especially since they're going to keep it, they really should, once again, put a little signage in, out. I think, once again, people will still do it, but I think it would cut down at least a little bit on that problem.
Yeah, and I saw that also a lot at in the dealer's room, because the entrance for the dealer's room was at the far end, and there was only one way to go down that hallway, so you had to actually go walk, essentially, past the entire dealer's room to get to the entrance. So, of course, the exit, you pass the exit as you go, so lots of people were, it was not clearly marked that that was the exit, and then security was there, like, you know, telling people to go down another way. So I think the dealer's room also needs it. And I don't want a little sign. I want a giant sign. Exit only. Dealer's room that way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, once again, sign. It's another indication that they need a little more signage. And, like, I, like, tweeted at them, they need "You Are Here." I think that would help a lot on a lot of the signage.
Definitely. And that came up a bunch at con feedback, on the forums. And I noticed that they had stuck some tape on a lot of those maps by the time I was looking at them on Saturday. Somebody had drawn like a little star on spots so you'd know this is where you were looking at. The dealer's room also inside needs a lot better signage because the exit for the dealer's room is not actually at the very end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit difficult to get out and figure out how to leave.
And I know people were complaining that like it was a little hard to tell where the aisles were, but the Otakon staff at ConFeedback mentioned that like they had a plan in place that just didn't come together in time. And they were going to hold, like, have banners come down and, like, mark the aisles. But apparently someone didn't time it out. I'm pretty sure, like, they would have had to have, like, convention staff, you know, fraud those down. And apparently they didn't get them made in time and then have, or they got them made, but then it was too late to get the people there to put them in or something like that. But yeah, they're like, next year, hopefully we'll have learned about the timing and be a lot better about it. And there'll be better signage of which aisles are which in the dealer's room in Artist Alley.
Oh, speaking of Artist Alley, seemed to be the one disaster that occurred over the weekend. And they took care of it fairly quickly. But about 8 p.m. on Saturday, all of a sudden, we're all headed to the Artist Alley, and it's closed. Nobody can go in, and they actually sent out an official press statement about this today, so thought I'd mention it here, too, is that, so what happened was, there was a massive rainstorm Saturday night, and the drainage system on the roof backed up, and it started waterfall into Artist Alley, hit some booths, and started flooding the floor. They closed it, got everybody out, moved the booths, and started cleaning up. And it was open again about 9:30. And they did a good job of sending out an alert through Guidebook about this so that people knew it was closed and when it opened again. So I thought that we can talk about it a little bit more, but I thought they really used Guidebook well this year for getting notices out. And they ended up, they said that they refunded artists. I guess there's a shipping stocking fee. I think it's probably like a union fee to get your stuff into the convention center. So that was refunded and people were able to bring and show staff any damaged goods. And two people were, like, slipped or something and were looked at by EMTs, but they were okay. So I guess there was a lot of misinformation floating around and they felt like they needed to...
Three people died!
And
$50 million worth of fan merchandise was destroyed.
$50 million of Voltron merchandise was destroyed in this horrible accident. Yeah, so there are some videos online people have of the waterfall coming in through the roof. And yeah, it is unfortunate that it hit a bunch of booths. And I'm just glad that it seems like Otakon did sort of the best that they could. And obviously, it wasn't really within their... You know, they had no control over that happening. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like they took care of it in a positive way. The only thing that really also made things difficult for anybody like me who had scoped out my artists and then all these booths had to move around and the map no longer necessarily lined up with where people were, and so trying to find anybody again became sort of very difficult. I was able to find the person that I was looking for, though, on Sunday, and I was very grateful for being able to do that. But yeah, that also threw kind of a wrench in anybody's plans, namely me, who does scouting. The Artist Alley was really great this year. It made me so happy because, you get this really great view of it when you when you're going there. You go down these escalators and there's you can look out on it, and it was so glorious and large. And if you've been to Otakon, the last few years at Otakon, it's actually been a lottery because there was just not enough space for as many artists that wanted to be there. And this was not the case. It looked like there was actually some empty space that they could have put more artists. So I'm really excited for the coming years when everybody hears how great the con is, that it's going to fill up even more. It's very exciting. And I love that, you know, maybe it won't have to be such a knockdown, drag-out fight trying to get a table there. And that'll bring more people.
And the legend of Artist Alley, stock trader Narutaki was born.
Write that doujin, guys. Charms are up. Buttons are down. Sell, sell, sell.
Yes. So, you talked about enjoying a lot of panels this year. I'm usually the person who goes to a lot of panels. I'll let you go first, since this is like a little bit of an oddity. What were some standout panels for you?
I really liked the cooking panel that I went to. That was...
Would you say, cooking is so fun? Cooking is so fun.
It is so fun. This panel was called, let me see, Anime Foodies Countryside Cooking. And what I liked about this panel was that they actually did all the recipes that they recommended. So they had made them, so they had pictures of them making it in progress and also the finished product. So they actually did it, so you know that it works. And they had ingredient lists and the recipe. And they also sometimes gave you a little bit of history about whatever the dish was. And they were saying that, oh, we'll probably do different themes because this was like countryside. And they could do all different kinds of cooking ones. The only thing that I kind of wanted was a little more anime in the panel. So each dish was based on, oh, we saw this in anime, you know, this anime, this episode, you know, and sometimes they show a clip, but sometimes they just show a picture. So I guess I always want my panels to be like a little more anime when it's cultural. So that was my only thing, but it was still really good and really yummy looking. I also really thought there was an analysis panel I went to on Saturday morning about Sailor Moon, and I thought the analysis was really good, and it also went into how Junichi Sato and Kunihiko Ikuhara sort of took what they learned on Sailor Moon and how they used it in later series for both of them.
I'm curious, now, you know, it just popped into my head. Did they talk anything about the third director?
No.
Because, yeah. Or you think it's just possibly because Stars hasn't had an official... Has Stars come out?
Not yet.
Okay, I wonder.
You know, Viz only licensed it like 6 years ago, Al. I mean, it takes time. I'll be dead. Our ancestors will get to watch Sailor Stars officially. I think, I'm not sure, you know, why the third director wasn't talked about, but it might have to do with, you know, whether those series, their following series sort of played off of the themes that he was talking, because he wasn't talking about Sailor Moon sort of as a whole, necessarily, he was talking about certain aspects of it, and then how those themes were shown later by those directors in other series. I did think that it almost needed a little more Sailor Moon in it, because I felt like there was a lot about, you know, taking it further in these other series, so a lot of time was spent on the other ones. I mean, there was a little Sailor Moon, but...
A little too much time welcoming you to Rock and Roll Night, welcoming you to Rock and Roll Fight.
I mean, that was a really good way to start Saturday, because that song was then in my head for the rest of the day. I I did, and I also learned at that panel one of the most important pieces of information that I could have ever learned, which was the writer for Gundam Wing, who was at the convention, was also the writer of the Rhett Butler cat episode of Sailor Moon. That, I cannot stress enough how important that information was to me.
Who's the guy who gets chased off by rats in that episode?
I don't remember. But yes, brilliant! Absolutely brilliant.
And cowardly thief tuxedo mask.
Just so good, you guys. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll put a link in the show notes. So I thought that was a really good just analysis panel. I guess this was a panel? I don't know. I don't know if it counts, but they had a Shinto shrine this year, and so I went to the opening ceremonies, and they were blessing, and everybody was actually very quiet and followed directions really well. I was impressed with all of us.
Yeah, I had forgotten to go to the Shinto shrine, and I remembered when people were discussing it, like, at con feedback. Like, not even at con feedback, when we were all, like, just hanging out a little bit at con feedback, after con feedback, and I was like, oh, man, I should have checked out that Shinto shrine. I never did. And I was only at Artist Alley for a while. There wasn't any kind of, like PA Works or some other person brought, a gallery or something like they have been in the last few years.
Not that I saw. I didn't see any special gallery. You're right. I kind of missed that. And PA Works themselves were in the dealer's room this year, whereas the last couple of years they've been in Artist Alley. So you're right, that was kind of a missing piece. That would have been really nice.
The two panels that stand out in my mind the most were probably, there was one on Japanese heraldry, which is, once again, one of those like topics that's like, I'm not sure how much other people are interested, but it's super out-focused. So, and the guy was pretty entertaining. He went through, like, mostly during, like, Warring States periods. He, like, focused on, you know, coats of arms and family crests and seals and banners. It was really interesting. And really makes me not envious of anyone who does, like, down and dirty historical research in that time period, especially since people constantly change their names and their family crests and like their symbols, and then they'll trade those things around as well. So I feel like really, like, you just see, ah yes, the guy known as Nobunaga did A, B, C, and D, but if you were to like do like research with the primary text, you know, he's, you know, the fool from Okinawa in this section, and then he's, you know, Nobunaga in this section, and he has a completely different title in this section of his life. So, made me very appreciative of that. And it was just an interesting look at, it's like a lot of minutiae that I think other panels would just skip over entirely. The other panel I thought was really good and worth pointing out, I only got to see the last third of it, but in a way, like, it was very clear that, like, I had come in during the conclusion, but he, like, very deftly at the very end, kind of almost like in the last paragraph, as it were, like, pulled together all the other parts and really gave me an impression of what the whole panel was like. And that was, there was the Alchemy of Fullmetal Alchemist. And it really shows that the author of Fullmetal Alchemist, she did her research. Because he just shows how, like, there's some very deliberate theming that goes beyond what, like, the surface level that you see. Like, even Al's whole color scheme of his outfit is a direct reference to the quest of the Philosopher's Stone. And, like, lots of other parts, like the Armstrong family, who you think is just, like, a silly brother and sister pair, is actually, like, super indicative of alchemical symbology. And you're like, wow! Like, just one great panel. Very what could have been a very dry topic, he made entertaining. And it really just really adds another dimension to Full Metal Alchemist. If you like that show, you should really track down that panel, because I feel like it really gives you a greater appreciation of how much is going on under the hood of that show.
Yeah, that sounded... I had that on my list and didn't make it. It sounded like I really should have tried to, because having somewhat recently watched the original series and planning to watch Brotherhood, think I would have gotten a lot out of it.
Yeah, it would have been, actually, you know, 20/20 hindsight, but I think, because he focused a little more on Brotherhood from what I could tell, I think he didn't give away too many spoilers, so I think if you had seen that panel and then watched Brotherhood, I would have like, oh, I see what you did there.
I hope that I'll see it at a future con, and hopefully by then I'll also have maybe watched Brotherhood, and it'll all come together very well. Okay, so trend-wise, what seemed popular? What were you surprised? Were you surprised to see anything, or was anything missing you thought would be there?
So, I might steal your thunder, but I was a little surprised, especially when you mentioned it, that there was not a lot more Attack on Titan, which I think says volumes.
It really stood out to me. Not that there was none, because in fact one of the final cosplayers I saw of the convention was a Levi cleaning cosplayer. But it was nothing. We just had a second season of it. It only recently finished. But there was not giant groups of people wearing the cloaks, and you know, it was not the monolith.
Yeah, I mean, from what you guys said, like, My Hero Academia was king.
Ooh, I think so. And unless something was king that I just don't recognize, which is totally possible.
Like, because I know you didn't pick up any of the Nier Automata.
Near a Tomato, yeah, that I don't know what that is, and I definitely did not recognize
it. And I think if you don't know what it is, it's easy to pass it up. I think it's just some kind of, like, robot-made goth thing. and you're just, you know, you're like, all right, that's a thing that's weirdly popular, eh? But no, it's from a popular game. That's pretty anime, so...
Yeah, but I thought My Hero Academia was everywhere. Cosplay, I saw a ton of it in Artist Alley. The other things I saw a lot of cosplay and Artist Alley-wise, Urien Ice, a lot of Urien Ice cosplayers, and then also like half cosplayers where they just had like Yurio's jacket, very popular item. And Persona 5 saw a lot of that, and I don't even fully know all those characters, so that's only me, like, half. I know the main guy is very distinct what he looks like, so if I noticed it just knowing a few characters, there was probably even more.
Was there a cat constantly telling everybody to go to bed?
No? Maybe?
Oh, I thought you had picked up on that meme.
Nope. I mean, I remember that there's a cat in it, but I didn't know there was any.
He's, like, super infamous for, like, making the character go to bed when you want to go out and do stuff in the game.
So he's, like, your mom?
Yeah, no, and people, like, super resent the cat for that. So, like, he is built up, like...
So like, no one would cosplay that cat because everybody's pissed off at him.
Look, Kate, you know that people specifically love to cosplay characters to get other people's hate on.
Or meme characters, I suppose. That's not unusual. And the other, the non-anime thing that was somewhat king of this con was Voltron.
Yeah, it was like, man, if Voltron isn't on this list, I would be shocked, especially since they just wrapped up a half season and it wasn't that long ago that they had the second season.
And it was all over Artist Alley. I think every single booth practically had something. And there was a ton of cosplayers, and like you said, that panel was totally packed. You know, couldn't even get all the people in. So... that was a really big, big one this year. A lot of Lance fans. Does Lance do something? And I mean, I haven't watched the third season yet, so no spoilers, but I have to question that quite a bit. Unless Lance does something in the third season that really, it's really significant, I worry about people.
I mean... like, would, like, a ton of Butler Guy fans be worse, or?
I don't know. I noticed, though, that, you know, I feel as if with the third season, everyone was really excited because Lotor is showing up. But I didn't then see tons of, say, Lotor
I wonder
art or something.
I wonder if he just came out a little too recently. Like, if it had come out, like, 3 months, 2 months before the con, not, like, the week before the con, you'd just be like, oh, there are other characters in this series other than Lotor. Who knew?
I'm kind of interested in that, but still makes me question the Lance thing. Because Lance sure as hell did not do anything in season two where I was like, yes, Lance is the best character.
Yep.
Anyway, nobody tell us. We're working on setting aside some time to see the third season. There's also a few things that I definitely didn't get to that I wanted to. So, like you said, Al, I don't even know where the AMV theater was. I had no clue right now. Couldn't tell you. I didn't make it to the Maid Cafe, but apparently no one... I don't know. Who are the people who get into that? Who? Because...
Maid fanatics?
I know no one who has ever actually made it into the Maid Cafe. And somebody brought it up at Con Feedback, so I'm hopeful that maybe they'll do something where it's a lot easier to register for a time to go there, because I know it's... you sign up and everything, but yeah, it's just... never been in there. There was some sort of, like, Lolita Garden. No idea where that was. Can you imagine if this con gets bigger? Because there were already places in the con that I didn't even go.
I know, and kids usually just person number one at the Lolita Garden. I did miss a panel. I was going to go to, like, Samurai Misconceptions, but instead I went to the video game room and, played in the Gundam Battle Pods because they had 4 Gundam Battle Pods and everybody could play against each other. But that line, even on slow times, was at least an hour long.
That's really cool that they had those.
So yeah, it was fun. I'm not a new type. I'm sorry. Or, you know, maybe I need to be bright slapped to bring out my full potential. But, until then, I did not do too well. I only killed, like, one person. And I mostly just got killed by Zeon suits.
What can you do?
I mean, it was fun. Hopefully, you know, we'll see them at other cons. I think they're worth checking out if you ever want to see how well you do apparently. I am Grunt who gets killed by Duo Maxwell in, you know, episode 2. But, you know, who knows, Kate? Maybe your true calling as the last Starfighter will appear.
I saw that they had some indie game section in there. I didn't get to check that out either.
I mean, I passed by them, but I just, like... But yeah, it seems they had about, like, 12, like, anime-related indie games. I know, through a picture, Elliot Page was super jealous because they had a whole Toho section that had, and I counted, 14 different Toho games.
Were you going to say Ho-Ho games?
Yes, a little bit. Toho games! Yeah, Toho games. Like, not all of them were the bullet shell hell shooters. There was, like, puzzle games and a few other types of, you know, like a fighting game and a few other kind of fan-made Toho games. But there was a whole darn Toho section.
That's impressive. And that game room was huge. Unbelievable. I just took a lap around to...
It was so huge, you didn't smell the video game room smell.
The only problem was when I went in there just to take a lap around, it was really dark. Mm. Was it really dark when you were in there?
Definitely in the back, I remember.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't have the lights on in there, but... The other thing that was nice was there was all those tables where you could play board games and card games. And it seemed as though you could also just sit down and... I don't think a lot of people knew that, but that you could just sit down and chill there if you needed to.
Oh, I do know also that... this is totally random and not related to anything. There was a decent number of places to eat inside the convention center, which should be mentioned for certain people. I mean, of course you have to pay the, I don't want to leave the building premium, but apparently the food wasn't wretched and you had to pay the, I don't want to leave the convention center premium, and it was pretty varied, which is also a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah, there was a lot of food. Although I did see in the forum, I didn't partake in any of the convention center food, so I can't say. From most reports, it seemed like the food was good or decent. The prices were high, but not crazy unreasonable, except for drinks. That seemed to be what people, they were like, oh, the food was kind of high, but it was the drinks that were way overpriced. And somebody also mentioned that despite how unadvertised a lot of the food places were, a lot of them ran out really early of food, so they didn't seem prepared for the con as much, I think people were saying. So, you know, I never eat convention center food, so I have no idea. I never really have a sense of, oh yeah, it was good or not, but it seemed like you did have a lot of options.
Yeah, which is always a, but yeah. I just always find that, like, I'd rather, like, hike 10, 15 minutes to get, like, a far better price. But it seemed like, you know, there are people who, you know, basically every second at the con counts for them. So it seemed like if you wanted to eat at the convention, I mean, you were going to have to pay a premium, but it was not the worst experience. So I thought that was worth mentioning.
So as far as things I'd like to see for 2018, I'd like them to rethink what they're doing in the Marriott. It didn't quite seem as though those rooms were really as well equipped and prepared for doing panels and doing video stuff. So, you know, not sure about that. And, oh, I should mention that I noticed a lot of HDMI problems at a lot of the panel rooms, including ours. We had to switch to VGA, which was not a big deal because I had the capability to do that, but a lot of computers now just use HDMI, so it seemed like kind of a bigger problem, and it had to do with the projectors. It was not people's computers that were the problem. And a lot of those problems seem to be fixed later in the convention. I didn't notice as many problems. So maybe dependent on the panel room or whatnot, but I did notice a lot of either it didn't work or the video was, like, not working properly, the audio was really low or something, so.
Yeah, hopefully it's just, like, them getting used to the convention center next year. Things will fly a lot smoother, but it is worth mentioning some that, you know, hey, you got your first year pass. Let's not see this next year.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, and I did want to say that I loved where press was. Really nice space. Great for interviews. Press lounge, all that. I thought it was very easy to get to. It was close enough to the convention that you weren't, like, going way out of your way. So that was nice as well. Keep it there.
I'd like to see a little more Japanese guests. I mean, in the end, I feel like this is a transition year, and there's a reason to break the bank, especially since, like I said before, I think attendance was down, and, you know, that cuts into their war fund for guests, and Japanese guests are expensive. So I'm hoping, maybe not even next year, but if next year really has a tick up that, you know, they returned to, like, previous levels of guests. And not that this year was bad, but I feel like it seemed more like high-end mid-convention as opposed to Otakon. And, you know, Expo just has and SakuraCon just have the convenience of being on the West Coast, which makes their lives infinitely easier. But, you know, somewhere in between this year and, you know, the big 20th anniversary year of guests would be nice. You know, like, one real showstopper. That's all. You don't need, like, Yoko Kanno and, you know, three other amazing, crazy guests. But maybe just one super great mangaka or one blow-your-mind director. Something that really, you know, makes you realize that, you know, Otakon's one of the big players.
Yeah, I think they had the Anisong guests, which were all really big, and so either, you know, hopefully they'll do that again, or have not, but non-music big guests would definitely be good. Somebody mentioned that I think next year's 25, so that should be a big thing, and somebody else.
They did at, I did go to the Otakon, like the Otakorp panel where the treasurer talked about it, and somebody directly asked them about what they were going to do for 25. They have a lot of plans. They're definitely planning big things for 25, but they didn't want to announce at this year anything that they weren't sure they could deliver on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think that they should. I'm just saying that it's 25. So, yeah. Like, I think people are hoping that that will be a big deal. And that, I think, when we were on the Anagamers podcast, Evan mentioned also that, you know, a lot of the guests were returning guests. So, you know, maybe some
new blood.
New blood, yeah.
Well, Kate, I did learn one thing about guests from the con feedback panel. And that Vic is definitely the Walking Dead of Otakon. It just seems like every year we go to New York Comic Con, every year we go to the feedback session, every year people complain about, I was nearly trampled to death trying to get into the Walking Dead panel. I had to fight, what do you call it, three people to get into the Walking Dead panel. And, like, probably the saltiest person was the person who was, like, did they line up for, like, over three hours on, like, Vic's autograph line and then didn't get...
And then there was some clusterfuck or whatever, yeah.
So, yes.
So, the final thing I want to say is thank you, thank you, thank you to whoever found my phone in Artist Alley and returned it very quickly to the staff. You really saved me. You are my hero. I wish I knew who you were. spread the word. I am looking for whoever it is to thank them. But it made me sort of believe a bit in my fellow congoers that, you know, it didn't disappear when I stupidly left it somewhere. So
that wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit reversethieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.